This episode is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Fed taper decision is just around the corner. Syria is going to play nice. And Twitter is going public. We have Harry Dent as a guest today and lots more information to talk with you about on episode number 330 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, man, I am talking about some fun now. We have Twitter going public. We haven't seen a company go public in how long has it been now? I mean, we've seen like this. I mean, we're talking about, of course, Facebook was the last one. Everybody gets scared off of anything to do with IPOs. But tech, revolutionary tech going to an IPO, this is pretty incredible. And they did it in a great way. They announced it on Twitter itself that they were going to be filing their various documents of the requirement that they will have to do to get this thing going. So this may be a little bit of a fast-moving IPO. They're not going to be dragging it out because they are under a special act where they're available to take advantage of certain things that were put into law to fast-track some businesses to IPO in order to get more employees. I don't know how many more employees Twitter needs. There was some time when it was two guys and a server. Obviously, a few more servers and a few more men and women that are working there now, but it is going to be pretty exciting. We'll see if, in fact, the recent move of Facebook up to its post-IPO high can actually help this stock in its delivery. One of the things that you have to note is that guess who is not going to be involved in the IPO distribution and offering? That's right, Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley, who was one of the reasons, as the information goes, that there was the big debacle with Facebook, is not going to be involved as at least the lead underwriter. I'm sure they get something to do with it. But Goldman Sachs is, at this time, said to be the lead underwriter for the Twitter IPO. So we'll see what kind of shares can be parsed out to the various syndicate that is involved with an IPO. Because with an IPO, you have the main underwriter, and they get a lot of shares. And what happens from there is they choose a syndicate to distribute it further, sell to their clients and to give it to their better clients if it's a good IPO, and to dish it out to those, I guess, that are smaller when it's not a good IPO. But what I think is really kind of interesting is the timing of this. Think about it. You had Facebook finally breach its IPO price, the IPO offering price a few weeks back. And then they breached the high, that IPO high where that day or so where it went to $45 and everybody thought it was just going to go up forever. And then we know the story from there. But what happened is that it did hit there. And what a coincidence. Twitter now announces they have an IPO. So they're looking for, obviously, a better sentiment in the markets, which is very smart of them, to find a time when they can, you know, come into the market. And at the same time, they're doing it at a time when there's a pretty good appetite for risk, you know, generally speaking. So this is an interesting time when we may see some additional offerings come up. At the same time, I will share with you that we've also been seeing a lot of distributions. In other words, a lot of shareholders and insiders have been selling shares. Now, there is some that say that, well, there is no real correlation between when insiders are selling and peaks of markets or peaks of a stock, because it could have been a planned sale. It could have been something that was done for some tax reasons. It could be because of leaving the company. There's a lot of different things that can go in there, and it may not be based on their overall belief in the companies or in the markets opportunity moving forward. On the other hand, when you see that shareholders on the inside that have knowledge of what's going on are buying shares, well, there's a little higher correlation to, hey, I think things are, you know, looks good here. It looks like it's an opportunity. So there is a little bit of a difference when we look at both sides of selling and buying, but it is noticeable and notable that we're seeing that there is this level of selling go on right now. Now, we did see also that where there's a lot of news that's been percolating about and a lot of speculation about what's going to happen with the Fed. Again, I'm sick of it. I want the Fed just out. Not that I want them to, you know, wreck the economy or wreck the markets, but I need them to be a little bit less vocal, less involved. You talk about Helicopter Ben, where he was, you know, dropping money out of the helicopter. Then you talk about Helicopter Moms, which are just overseeing everything and micromanaging their kids. That's kind of what we're really getting to at this point, where the Fed is micromanaging every single thing, and every single news item when it comes to economics are moving stocks dramatically. You see that Friday isn't a great example, when there was a really poor consumer confidence number come out on top of a weak retail sales number came out. Markets really came in pretty strong, and then all of a sudden turned around and went much higher. Now, whether that was because the speculation that there would be some kind of an agreement with Syria between U.S. and Russia, which there quote-unquote was a quote-unquote agreement, or better yet, the words that actually were said was there's a framework. And we've talked about my thoughts on what the word framework means. It means nothing. It means we're hoping that we're going to get something done here. But basically, they've agreed that Syria said, hey, you know what? Okay, we're going to take all of our chemical weapons and we're going to put it over here in this place over there. UN inspectors and U.S. and Russia, you guys can come in and destroy all of them. Now, this is a week after the Syrian leader, Assad, said, we're not using any chemical weapons. And, you know, what are you talking about? So I'm a bit confused of what's really going on here. But at least there is this whole thought of a diplomatic process and a diplomatic solution that's going to be taking place that will take a lot of heat off concern about the whole Mid East. We'll see what happens with oil and gold. Gold already, you know, plummeted on Thursday and Friday. Really big moves on the downside and for no reason that could be really explained by what was going on. Oil started to come in, and that probably was due to the fact there was less anxiety over the whole Syrian situation. But I would be very surprised if this all ends so easily. That seems too neat and tidy at this point. So we'll watch that. We'll see what happens. And obviously the main issue there is that any further unrest in the Middle East on top of the Egypt situation that's going on in Syria, and, you know, it's a real problem. Now, the big question of the day on a total side note is what is going to be the ramifications with Assad? If in fact it's proven that he did use chemical weapons, is the world going to do anything or just, okay, you know, he's not doing it anymore? I really wonder about that. And if in fact nothing occurs, what are going to be what's going to be the fallout from that? And how are we going to see other leaders who are in the mindset of totally, you know, looking to just eradicate those that are opposed to them? How are they going to react to this? What are they going to do? And what are they going to feel that their limitations or not are moving forward? We also have this coming Wednesday, another big event. This is pretty big because this is the crescendo of what everybody's been worrying about, talking about, fearing, concerned about, speculating about, and that is whether or not at this meeting, the September meeting, which is the one that has been telegraphed for months now, is the time when the Fed is finally going to say, yes, we are going to start tapering our bond purchases. $85 billion a month of MBS and Treasury that they have been buying has been flowing into the banks. Don't forget, the mortgage-backed securities, a lot of that money goes into the banks because they have a lot of debt in the form of mortgages and mortgage-backed securities on their books. It gets extracted and put on the books of the Fed, thereby giving the banks all this money freed up at a great price. They sold the stuff, by the way, to do what they're going to do, which is, you know, invest, do all sorts of things with it, clean up their balance sheets, and maybe even put it into their prop trading before that shut down. So We have all that happening. And on top of that, two more things, governmental issues that we have to look at, which is number one, whether or not this whole Fed chief situation is going to be resolved in any reasonable time. Already we heard at the end of the week that the president will not be naming a chairman of the Fed this week coming up. Okay. One of the reasons probably is because there's a lot of flack happening and a lot of talk happening about Larry Summers. There was some leaks by the Nikkei and some things happened at the meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming last month that, hey, Summers is the guy. That's what the decision is going to be. And yet at the same time, now we're finding, of course, that New York Times article that just obliterated and really took him down pretty hard. And on top of that, you know, we're now finding many people are opposed to Summers being in that position, and they're very vocal about it. We're really letting now public and political opinion sway this whole situation when it's a presidential appointment. So I don't know where we're going with this, but it's getting, once again, much too loud in terms of the participation of others that are involved potentially in this decision. You know, who else is there? There's Janet Yellen, of course, we've mentioned, and Janet Yellen probably has the most experience working with Bernanke for years and has pretty much the same frame of mind with quantitative easing and easy money process that Bernanke has, or I've even thought more so. I don't think I've ever seen her in a speech say anything other than extremely dovish commentary about continuing with quantitative easing. Last week, we also saw Apple come out with their big exciting, dynamic. Oh, it was so boring, actually. They come out with the 5C, which I think stands for 5 China, not 5 color, which has a 5 different colors, the pinks, the blues, all these plastic cases, plastic screen. And I thought it was really interesting how they introduced how great the colors are. And then they said, hey, by the way, we also have a great case for it. I'm thinking, wait a minute. You have all these great colors and you're going to cover it up with a case? How does that make any sense? But it's a lower price point, maybe better for certain countries that are looking to get into the get iPhones at a cheaper price point. And then they came out with the 5S, which has a better processor, all sorts of nice gadgetry like a biometric fingerprint scanner, although they didn't come out with an NFC, which would have been near-field communications for payment modes. But it is a much faster processor, the A7. It comes in gold, silver, black. I don't really have the urge to go out and, you know, trade in my 4S for the 5S at this point. I don't see that much of an incremental difference, even though they're giving away a few things and it has a faster processor. It doesn't seem like it's going to be something that people are going to be running towards. Do you? I mean, are you going to run for it? If you have an iPhone right now or you are waiting for the 5S to turn in some other device to possibly go for an Apple iPhone at this point, you know, you can get a 4S, I believe, on a 2-year contract for free at this. You know, that's amazing. Okay, it doesn't have the bigger screen. It doesn't have the same display and all that. It's a little slower processor. But, you know, there gets to be a point, I think at least, where the incremental difference is not that great. There was a big difference between the 3 and the 4, the 4S, of course. There's a big difference between the 4 and the 5s. But now the 5 to the 5S, it didn't seem that dramatic to me. As a matter of fact, it was one of the only Apple events that I did not watch all of the action until the end. Maybe I'm just used to it. Maybe it wasn't exciting. I thought there would be something a little bit more that was introduced. And in fact, the stock reacted appropriately, or at least as appropriately as I saw it, dropped down pretty significantly into the 465 range or so. Now, one of the things they're also talking about in the news I thought was really cool was something called phablets, PH. These are the phone tablets. These are like those Samsungs that are gigantic compared to what the standard smartphones are. They look much bigger. They're smaller than an iPad mini. They're bigger than a normal smartphone. But at the same time, these are the things that maybe hold the key to the next generation of the merge and the convergence of the tablet computer and the phone, because you're going to have much greater space to do things. It's very difficult to work on an iPhone and even a tablet, I think, for things like Excel spreadsheets and real work. I see the iPhone as a much more, and tablets as a much more of a consumption device. Now, Microsoft is trying to do what they can to make it almost a laptop replacement. Matter of fact, they're coming out pretty strong with the commercials lately, and they're also offering a $200 trade-in, basically, for your iPad. Give them your iPad, you get the Surface, and you get a $200 credit towards, I guess, that or the Microsoft Store. We'll see how that flies. But the competition is heating up. I think I saw that, was it Nokia? There was somebody that announced some unbelievable number of phones they're about to come out with. I thought it was 700, but that just can't, it doesn't seem right. Maybe it was 75. 75 new models? I got to look for that. That was something I found very interesting. And also mentioned that gold traders right now, if you've been watching gold at all, gold traders are the most bearish they've been since July, about 2 months ago. If you watch what happened with gold and silver, I'll be honest, we had a short on silver and just a trading position short on silver through, I believe it was, a week ago. And it was very painful to watch after we closed that position because we didn't want to hold it over the weekend due to, you know, the trading, what we had and the targets that we had. And it was just not doing anything. So, you know, we said, okay, you know, we'll open it again next week. And there it goes. Silver just got, you know, bludgeoned. And it happened very quickly, almost too fast to actually act on. Sometimes that happens. You move on, you wait for the next opportunity, the next signal, the next level that you can get into something. And I think that's probably the best thing instead of beating yourself up. But, you know, do yourself a favor. We always talk about this. Don't not think about getting into it again because you got burnt on it or you didn't profit on it or you didn't get it at the right time. Look for the next opportunity. Always do that. I'll mention before we get to Harry Dent that the Trigger Charts webinar is very well attended. If you have not made a reservation, it's free. Go over to triggercharts.com or thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There are places where you can just click on and put in your name for a quick registration and register for the event. If nothing else, even if you don't do active trading, it's a good lesson in understanding certain components of charts, charting, and how the markets work from what's called a market profile, looking at volume and looking at price. So I think that was something you really should take a look at and look to do. As a matter of fact, we are doing the official unveiling of the indicators that we built for TradeStation on the 25th of September. So anybody that's using TradeStation, there's a whole showcase they're doing for us to go over the various indicators that we have, how they work, etc., for all of the clients of TradeStation. So if you have it or you don't have it, you should still take a look at that. And I mentioned that just for the heck of it, if you don't have TradeStation and using some other charting platform, TradeStation's offering a freebie. You don't have to pay for the platform at all. I think you just have to open an account through the end of this year. So all that information is over at triggercharts.com. Let's see what else I wanted to get to here. Oh, I'll mention something. I did mention that Audible, we had them as a sponsor of the shows some time ago. Well, they came back, and I'm really happy about that because there are so many great books that are out there, and oftentimes the guests that we have on, you can actually go and get their book. If you're not an Audible subscriber, you get this great 30-day free trial, which is so awesome because we're going to listen to Harry Dent. We're going to talk with him a bit, and then, well, maybe you want to get his book. Well, you can go do so. There's a few of them that are available, as a matter of fact, on audible.com. For example, The Great Crash Ahead, which he wrote back in 2011, and also The Great Debt Crisis Ahead. Both of those, very popular on Audible. And you go simply to, this is so easy, you just go over to audiblepodcast.com/discipline. audiblepodcast.com/discipline. If you can't remember that, we'll have it right in the middle of the page on the show notes for this episode. You go there, and what you do is you just, you know, do a quick trial, and you get a free audiobook plus a 30-day trial. How great is that? So you can grab, we'll find out what Harry has to say in a second, but if you like the kind of things that he's saying, or even any business books, there's hundreds of thousands of titles there. Great thing, because you know, how many times do you want to do something like, I don't know, maybe you're in your car, or you're on a train, or you're in the middle of something, and you just don't have the time to read a book, or you just can't carry it with you, or you don't have your particular, well, you just, you know, put it on and listen. Great stuff. Audible.com. So go to audiblepodcast.com/discipline and get your free book, whatever it may be, whether you want Harry's book or not, from there. Great stuff. All right, let's get to the next section here where we spend some time with Harry Dent, and then I'll kind of wrap it up after our conversation with a few things that I want to tell you about. Actually, I have a coupon for a discount for you for something. You can take some money off of a great subscription. And I also have a couple other goodies that I want to share with you about the earnings that are coming up this week for a couple of major technology companies. So let's kind of get on to the next section here. Our guest today, as mentioned, is Harry Dent, and he is the editor of the free newsletter, Survive and Prosper. And you get that over at harrydent.com, which is very easy. And Harry, we haven't talked for a while. How are you doing?
Oh, no, I'm doing great. I mean, you know, the Fed keeps stimulating the economy and things keep going up a bit, you know, even with the Syria challenge and everything else. But I really, Andrew, after many years of studying this artificial recovery, I think we're coming near the end of this. I think stocks are going to go higher after a correction here over the debt debate and things like that into, you know, October or so. But I think the Dow is going to hit 16,000, a little bit higher, and then I think that's going to be a major long-term top. In the first half of 2014 is going to be the most important time for investors to protect themselves against the next 2008-2009-like crash, which I think is ultimately going to be a little bit worse.
Well, it's interesting because, we have very short memories. And, you know, I was reading an article a couple of days ago about what's going on in the Hamptons. And they're back at, you know, amazing prices for building homes and, you know, cars and champagne and, you know, $3,000 multi-liter bottles of Pierre Jouet. And, I mean, you know, the rich got richer. And the interesting thing is that the Fed keeps on seemingly making a case for why they need to continue stimulating. And it's almost like we don't remember when there was time when there wasn't this. And this is not only here. The only thing that I've heard different anywhere on this story around the world has been that Indonesia did a slight rate increase. And that was it. So I don't know how long this is going to go on. Maybe if we're all devaluing at the same time, who cares concept. But you talk about how many are there? 13 triggers. Okay.
There's more than that, but yeah, 13 are the minimum we can come up with. You know, Andrew, I mean, it's a great point. This whole recovery is seeing the middle class, just like the last boom in the 2000s, go nowhere. And still a lot of underwater mortgages and declining wages because the whole Asian assault since the mid-90s of lower cost industrial goods. And the upper class that has benefited from this incredible speculative boom where stocks go higher and financial assets and real estate go higher, the Fed has literally, since Greenspan in 1987, has prevented the markets from going down. Every time they go down, they come in and lower interest rates. They come in with QE. And it's created this you-can't-lose speculating environment, which creates greater and greater leverage, you know, LBOs and mergers and acquisitions and all this crazy stuff, rising debt at the financial, consumer, and business levels. And this debt bubble started to burst in 2008 when we predicted 20 years ago that baby boomers would slow in spending and the housing thing would slow down. And governments have just stepped in and said, no, we can't let this happen. This is the most fiscally irresponsible thing I've seen in all of modern history for hundreds of years, and it's going to fail because demographics are going to get only worse in the United States when the upper class sees their kids leave college and peak in their spending several years after the everyday family did in 2007, and when Europe falls off the demographic cliff and then South Korea and other Asian countries after Japan, and even China is already starting to fall off this cliff. We have a decade of slowing ahead where everybody, governments, China, U.S., Europe, are stimulating like crazy, and Japan even more, thinking we can blow our way out of this. There's no way you can blow your way out of this, and we're going to have a big reckoning or crisis in the next 6 years by all of our cycles, and I have incredibly good cycles, and they all turn down by early 2014 into late 2019, and we're going to have a big crisis, and I think it's going to come sooner than later. I think 2014 and 15 are going to be the worst years we've seen in the stock market for a long time, worse than 2008-9. So I'm just telling people, look, yes, it's a reality that the Fed and central banks are stimulating the economy and they keep driving the markets up, but this stock boom is on its fifth year, and there's been no stock booms that have lasted past this, despite beyond the boom of the 90s throughout history, and Japan's rebounds in markets have not lasted past 4 to 5 years. So I think we're getting ready to see another crash ahead.
And by the way, the big difference between this particular stock market move and rally in the last few years compared to the ones that you're talking about, the other ones were primarily driven by innovation and new products and a whole different cycle of what was going on from a level of investing in opportunities. This one, yes, there has been some global expansion, you know, where companies like a Starbucks or, you know, pick your poison, what you want to look at, Amazon. You know, they've been there, but they've obviously been able to, number one, tap very cheap credit. Number two, they've been able to expand, I mean, just widen out their reach. And the third thing is, because of technology, they have lower cost overhead and structure. I mean, Amazon is basically selling their digital books at the same price as regular books. That was not in the theory, in the thesis, when we all thought about digital books, right?
Yeah, you know, you're right, Andrew. I mean, the boom of the 90s, and we called it, nobody called the boom of the 90s for U.S. and Europe, and nobody called the downturn in Japan in the late 80s. And we did, because we were looking at what you said, the fundamentals. The baby boom generation was in their highest spending increase years in the 90s, and they were going to continue to spend more at a lesser rate into around 2007. Technologies, internet, broadband, cell phones, smartphones, all these things were accelerating from 10% to 90% of households, just like automobiles and electricity and radios and phones did into the roaring 20s. So this was a great boom, but now we're in a great bust. And if it weren't for over $10 trillion in QE from governments around the world and endless stimulus programs and endless overbuilding of infrastructures in China, where they have 26% of homes vacant in China and cities, and moving more and more people from rural to urban areas with no skills, that are going to be the first to be laid off and be unemployed when the economy shuts down. These people are going to go back to rural areas and leave already overbuilt cities in China even more overbuilt. It's a disaster waiting to happen, and China is the worst bubble to burst ahead, not the U.S. or Europe. Europe is slumping and keeps slumping in southern Europe, and they will, and that's going to trigger a problem in the next year. China's real estate bubble is now getting out of control again, despite the government's effort, because of its shadow banking system, just like ours in the U.S. and in the late 2000s. And we're going to see a big blow up, and I think it's going to happen in the first half of next year.
Well, you know, I've read your books from the beginning, way back when, and when you were talking about things like, and it sticks in my head all the time, the S-curve, looking at computers and how they were going to be, you know, from a mainframe to a desktop to a laptop to something smaller. And at that time, it was like, oh, come on. You know, how much smaller are we going to get than a laptop, you know? And, you know, all this and how that just goes along with any other curve of technology. And, you know, the old, you know, two times faster, one half the price, et cetera. But one of the other things that I really like, I'm telling everybody listening about Harry, is that he uses a lot of the demographic economics. And I want to share a couple of things. This is actually Harry, I got this great book sent to me. I don't know if you saw this, but it's The Pocket World in Figures, 2014 edition by The Economist. Check this out. And this is, I haven't talked to Harry about this, but I want to kind of give you something. This is where my problems with Japan come in. And by the way, this is why Japan has gone to such extreme measures. It's almost like if they were playing poker, they're all in at this point. And the interesting thing is this, that the population, in terms of population, the birth rates and the lowest birth rate in the world is Germany. Next to Germany is Japan, okay? Then you have the median age. The median age of the world, the Monaco is the first, but Japan is the second. I say, oh, they're healthy people. But that's not the point here when we're talking about economics. And then you have life expectancy is the second largest in second longest in Japan. And when you go through this and you look at where there is going to be a problem, because when you have the age scale, if you will, tilt into a situation where you have Japan again as the median age being 44.7, the second highest in the world, versus some of the other countries around the world that have a much lower, people that are able to be in the workforce. The problem is the older you get, the less you participate in the economy, and that's where Japan's having their big problem.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, I've got a new book coming out in January, The Demographic Cliff, and you know, we predicted 20 years ago that Japan would decline first of all the major nations because they didn't have a major baby boom after World War II, unlike Europe and the United States. But then the U.S. would be next, and Europe's going to be after that. And then there's more and more countries around the world, including China, of the emerging countries, that fall off this cliff in spending. When people get their kids out of school and college, they spend less and save for retirement. So this, you know, governments are saying, this is a temporary debt crisis in 2008. If we can just stimulate our way out of this, we'll get back to normal. There is no getting back to normal here. Spending will be lower and lower. Saving will be higher and higher. Debts will be paid down, not accumulated. We're going into a deflationary era like the 1930s. The governments are just slowing this. And again, it started in Japan. It hit the U.S. and North America. It's going to hit Europe next. Europe's already in deep problems because of their debt and uncompetitiveness in Southern Europe. And they haven't gone off the demographic cliff yet. They're going to start to do that in 2014 and beyond. So we have more of this demographic downturn to come, more debt deleveraging to come, and governments are just going to run out of bullets trying to fight this. I think by mid-2014, the Fed and central banks are just going to fail in their stimulus programs after tapering, which, you know, if they start tapering, which they're probably going to do in September, only a little bit, once they start tapering, it would take a big move for them to reverse that and say, oh my gosh, we're going to stimulate again. By the time they read the economic statistics slowing into next year, every 7 quarters, we've had up and down with stimulus. Stimulus doesn't last. It's temporary. By early to mid next year, we're going to be heading down again in the economy, and I think the Fed's going to be too late to react. And the China bubble and the Southern Europe depression is going to weigh on our economies globally, and we're going to see a downturn just like the subprime crisis in U.S. real estate triggered the last downturn. You can't trigger a major downturn over 4 states in the United States unless the whole economy is overstretched with debt and slowing it.
But the only difference now, Harry, is that the debt, while it's been renewed, we have a lot of debt outstanding. I'm not talking about the U.S. government. I'm talking about companies and individuals. It's at a much lower rate. Now, at the same time, I would say and throw this into there that, okay, so it's at a lower rate, but if you can't pay it, it doesn't matter, whatever the rate is, the debt service. And that's the big problem that we have in Japan also, just to go back to there for 1 second, is that they have been issuing all this debt and they're doing quantitative easing. And the problem is that now they have to do something about collecting money from taxation, hoping that the economy gets better or something happens, that they can actually create a higher tax, which is anti-stimulus, right?
Yeah, I mean, okay, the first thing to realize is that governments around the world, and Japan is the worst, they have 250% debt to GDP just in their government debt,
yep.
Not to count their private debt. If you add it all up, it's like six times GDP, unprecedented, two times GDP at the worst for U.S. before the Great Depression. They can only fund this debt because the government and all their financial institutions are buying the government's bond and keeping interest rates low. The U.S. government, the Fed, is buying 60 to 70% of our own bonds to keep interest rates low. And despite that, and with accelerated QE in the last several months, interest rates are going up because the markets are seeing the Fed can't do this forever. Interest rates are going to go up. The interest on all these massive debts, private and government, are going to go up. And that's the first trigger that stops the endless stimulus program. But the worst triggers are Southern Europe blows up and a few countries leave the euro. If China's real estate bubbles burst, I'm telling you, it's going to be the biggest thing that's happened in the last 100 years in global history. 220 million people who are illegal immigrants by China's definition, no public services, not registered in urban areas that they've moved into, are going to move back to their shacks in rural areas to survive, and China's going to be the biggest overbuilt bubble in real estate and infrastructures in history, and they're going to prove, Andrew, that governments are not the best drivers of free market economies. The economy is a better driver. China's going to prove this top-down, government-driven capitalist model wrong.
Well, one of the things about China is also we don't exactly know if their data is believable, but that's for another discussion. I do also want to mention...
It's not believable.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Never believable.
Right. The other thing is, we just saw that Bank Montepaschi of Italy needs another $4 billion bailout, and they're going to do something of a restructuring in order to qualify for that. And we all see that Greece is looking to get either forgiveness, which is not, quote-unquote, not going to be allowed, especially during a German election cycle, or at least not going to be talked about being allowed. And at the same time, you know, you're seeing that the entire promise that was made that really started the initial surge of the European shares by Draghi, he has not been funded at all. And I'll tell you something else, just to pick on Japan one more time, then we'll move on. I think, from everything that I can see, this stimulus in Japan, what they did, this program that they announced in this three-quivered, arrowed stool, is, besides the fact that I think it's way over the top and problematic, but I think that this is the reason why we're seeing such enormous volatility in commodities, not the foods, that's a different story, but in commodities, why we're seeing this big rush up inside of equity markets around the world, clearly, and I can't see it ending very well because there's just it's too much. It's too heavy of a weight for them to be bearing right now, and I'm surprised their rating hasn't been cut yet.
You know, it is the biggest enigma in history. Japan has had, we were the only ones to forecast in the late 80s that Japan was going to see a 12 to 14 year downturn. Well, you know, we were wrong about that. They've had a 23 year downturn because they fought the downturn with endless QE, just like we're doing in the U.S. and Europe, never let the debt deleverage, never let the burden come off of the private sectors, and their government debt has gone from 60% of GDP to 250% to fund this. This is absolute economic suicide. And on top of that, like you said, the Japanese don't encourage immigration, and they have the lowest birth rates in the world, along with Southern and Central European countries and East Europe and Russia, all areas that are going to decline is for decades ahead just on pure demographics. Japan is a bug looking for a windshield, as John Malden said, one of the authors I respect.
Oh, John's great, isn't he?
You know? Yeah. No, I mean, it's a bug looking for a windshield, but here's the difference, Andrew. Near term, Japan has been in this 23-year downturn, 21 years in real estate, 23 years in the economy and stock, and they are getting a rebound because they're the only major country in the world that has demographic headwinds in their favor. because of the next generation, and they're still not recovering much. But this stimulus, I think, may last for some time in Japan, but in the long term, we look at Japan, their demographics are the worst in the world. And you're right, Germany, Southern Europe, Austria, and Switzerland, think about it. Germany supposed to hold up the European Union to this crisis. Germany's demographic trends have already been slowing in population, and their spending wave by our demographic calculation is going to decline from 2014 forward. I mean, their workforce is going to shrink 33% in the next 40 years. This is a disaster like Japan in the making, and nobody sees it coming because nobody looks at demographics, the simplest leading indicator.
I hear you. Now, let me talk about a couple of other things that I want to mention. Harry's you have a conference coming up, I know, called the Irrational Economic Summit in November, right?
Yes. Yeah, November 6th to 8th in La Jolla, California. I mean, we're going to have, you know, not only Rodney and I speaking, but, you know, 15 other speakers. George Gilder was the greatest forecaster of the technology boom of the 1990s, as we were, and he is going to speak there. I don't know how we got him to speak. He used to command such speaking fees I've never heard of, but he likes what we're saying, and he wants to reach our audience. So,
that's great.
You can go to harrydent.com, I think, and sign up for that as well.
And also, there's a couple of things that you talk about I really want to kind of throw out there, because some of these numbers are really pretty wild. I mean, you know, we'll talk about the market and the predictions, what you have on the Dow and all, but you have been very vocal about the potential crash, just absolute obliteration of prices of gold, right?
Gold and stocks.
Yeah, but let me preface this for one second, because I think this is really fascinating what we need to think about before you, when you're going to answer this. What's interesting is that in theory, you know, in general theory, that a tangible asset should have valuation when you see other assets like paper assets declining. This is a simple run for protection, and it is a fear trade, and it is one of those places that you go when you want to get shelter from the rain, from the thunder, and from the storm. But yet, at the same time, you're predicting that gold is going to crash, which kind of in modern day theory flies in the face of, if stocks go down, well, at least you're going to have something that's going to, you know, hold up well. So now you can answer. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, like you said, in modern day theory and ideology, I'm not into ideology. It's the only reason I can forecast booms and busts in everything. I'm not a bull. I'm not a bear on gold or stocks or the economy or anything. Everything goes in cycles. To look at reality, when the last financial crisis actually occurred in late 2008, and banks and investment banks started melting down, and AIG in the stock market crash, guess what happened to gold? It went down 33%. Mm-hmm. Guess what happened to silver? Went down 50%. Commodities crashed. Stock markets in the U.S., Europe, emerging markets, China, they all crashed. Everything went down, which means diversification doesn't work in a deflationary bubble. When bubbles build up from excess debt, financial assets are the biggest beneficiaries, stocks, everything, and then when it goes down, they all go down. Gold was the greatest hedge against the inflationary downturn of the 1970s. But gold, we've said it's going to crash. It's already crashing. I mean, I debate Peter Schiff and Porter Stansberry and all types of people who just say gold's going to go to 5,000 and the U.S. dollar's going to go to zero, and we're saying no. In the last crisis, when it finally happened, even though gold went up in the early stages, gold went down. The U.S. dollar went up. The U.S. dollar safe short-term bonds are the safe haven. Gold is a commodity. And when the global economy turns down and debts deflate, gold is going to go down. I think gold could see $250 in the next 6 or 7 years, and at least $700 to $750 in the next few years. Gold's going down. I
wait. Is that how much is going down, or what the price is going to be?
No, that's how much going down. The price is going to be $250, as low as that, in the early 2020s.
Wow.
And it's going to be probably at $700 to $750 in the next few years. But I think gold has seen a big sell-off, and I think, again, what gold does is rallies in the early stages of a downturn or crisis, like in early 2008, and then it declined. I think gold's probably going to go back up to $1,500 or a little bit higher, and then I would sell it for people. We got people out of gold and silver a long time ago, but people who still have it, I wouldn't sell out now. I think gold's got more upside in the next several months than downside, but...
Yeah,
I don't think it's going to go much over $1,500, and I would get the hell out of it.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's talk about India for a second. This is one of the places that you like, and I find some interesting little things that are going on there. The rupee, the currency of India, has been smashed. Would that be a right word?
Decimated.
Now, this is something that was market-driven, okay, that, you know, India, a variety of different reasons why, but been just decimated. And... what's interesting is that many countries attempt to do this to take their currency down because it aids in their exports, right?
Yes.
But somehow this also killed India. So how is India so much different in terms of the valuation of their currency when it comes to exports and sparking the economy versus other countries?
Okay, here's the big thing, Andrew. It's very simple. India does not export that much as a percentage of their economy. They're not an export machine like China or Germany and many European countries. And Korea is the biggest export machine in the world. So when exports go down, these countries get hit enormously. Well, India has had an imbalance in their trade accounts. They've been buying more gold and stuff from the world and exporting less, but they only export 10 to 12% of their economy like the U.S. So to me, this is a short-term crisis for them. It's a good thing that their rupee's going down. It's bad for gold, another thing bad for gold, because Indians are the biggest single buyers of gold in the world, and China second, not the U.S., not Europe. So this rupee decline has been one of the reasons gold's been falling. But I think... India, I would not buy India stocks now because I think, you know, emerging countries are going down, commodity prices are going down as we predicted on a 30-year cycle for years. But when we see the next great crash into 2014 or 15, India would be one of the first places I would buy because they've underinvested in infrastructures and China has overinvested. China's going to see the biggest long-term downturn anybody's seen, and the world's going to say, what's the next great emerging country? And they're going to say, it's India. If they just had infrastructure. I've been to India three times in the last 6 or 7 years. Indian people are incredibly innovative and creative. They just don't have infrastructure.
Yeah, no, that's a big issue. I mean, I agree with you because I haven't been to India yet. I've been around the world otherwise. And, you know, you could see like the Philippines, a similar kind of situation.
Yeah.
You know, and Philippines is more of a bit of an archipelago, so it's different than India. But there still is a very bright culture, well-schooled. That's why, by the way, probably...
And English-speaking,
by
large.
That's the whole point.
That's a huge advantage.
Yep.
The Japanese and the Koreans don't have that advantage.
Right. That's why you have the two biggest call center places in the world, pretty much are India and the Philippines. And you wouldn't know the difference, you know, if they didn't tell you their name or whatever. And some of them even one of the things I did learn was that in the call centers, they have training to learn different accents depending on where they're talking to.
Yeah, my stepdaughter's in that business, helping Asian people to have better English accents.
Isn't that great?
It's a huge growth industry.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. So, in terms of India now, so, you know, one of the things that happened recently was, you know, again, this continued drop, really bad market conditions. But when the government did a little bit of intervention to at least stop the rupee from declining, the market actually perked up nicely. So, again, it's opposite of what you would think. In terms of
But again, Andrew, that's always BS. Governments only do one thing, react to bull and bear markets, ups and downs, and try to balance everything and put the economy like it's a machine that can grow at 3% or 7 or 8% in emerging countries with 0 to 2% inflation. This is the greatest misconception in history. Economists don't know their ass from a hole in the wall.
Yeah.
The economy has to boom and bust. It has to have new innovations that challenge old industries. And then you have to have creative destruction and downturn. You have to have inflation. Inflation is the greatest stimulus of mass practical innovations like the automobile in the early 1900s and personal computers and internet in recent times. And then the greatest deflations or downturns bring the cost of living down, bring real estate down, and set the stage with radical innovations long-term like computers or jet airplanes for the future. Economists don't understand our economy. They think it should be a machine. This is the greatest misconception I've ever seen. And I'll tell you, another book people should read if they have the stamina, David Stockman's book, The Great Deformation. It's 712 pages. Wow. I'm plowing through it now. It is so accurate about how governments constantly and major businesses and Wall Street fight the free market system. They don't want the innovation. They want to fix things. They want to make everything like a machine, and it is the worst thing we've ever done.
Well, it's for one reason. And they want the votes. It's the votes. All about the votes.
Yeah, and Japan's in a coma economy for 2.5 decades because they've done the same thing, and we think we're going to get something different. If we do not let this debt deleverage and restructure our economies and favor the good banks and businesses that succeeded and let the bad ones go down, we're going to be in a coma economy like Japan. This is the worst thing I've ever seen in history, ever, ever, ever.
Well, lots of luck, because it seems to me that the main goal of all this is to protect the banks at all costs, no matter what they do,
yeah,
how they do it, where they do it, who is against. I mean, you know, right now the focus has been on J.P. Morgan, right? They're, you know, you're looking at J.P. Morgan. There's massive fines on all sorts of different things, massive losses. They had the $4 billion whale trade. Take a look at the stock. Doesn't flinch. Does not flinch.
Hey, but look, Andrew, at China's stock market, the Shanghai Composite. It had a collapse 70% in 2008, had a brief rally into early 2010, and has been declining and back near its lows ever since.
Yeah.
How could the greatest economy in history with 10%, 8 to 12% growth have a declining stock market? Because they're overbuilding everything. Overcapacity means high fixed costs, high debt, and low profits. The China stock market is telling you the whole recovery in the world, especially China, is BS. And the fact that it takes $2 trillion every year in fiscal deficits and in monetary stimulus just to get us up to 2% real growth.
Which may be revised.
$2 trillion to create, yeah, $350 billion in growth?
Yeah.
That's the worst ratio I've ever seen in history. If we did not have this massive stimulus, and if the Fed does taper, which they're likely to do in September, starting slowly, this economy is going to go hell in a handbasket in the next year. There's no other way. Without stimulus, we would have been in a depression already.
You know, what's interesting is you talk about the economists, and obviously when you're thinking about demographic economy, economics, you have to merge the whole age issue. You also have to merge the people. You have to also merge in what is the economic numbers showing us, right? So that's part of it. What is with the economic numbers when you see the revisions and the sloppy reports that come out with all sorts of caveats? And it's really, I think, gotten pretty bad over the last couple of years, the level of reports that we get. And, you know, you can't do anything but take them at face value, because it is what it is, right? You know, if they're gonna report something like they did last quarter, where they had, let's say, round number 2% GDP,
yeah, then 2.7% GDP,
and then it went down to whatever it was, like nothing. You know, how does that happen? How does that happen?
Well, first of all, governments always tend to overstate growth and understate inflation because it's good for politics. And China is so bad, it's unbelievable. Their growth. I was in South Korea talking with an economist on the same stage there in China, and he's saying 8% growth? No, probably 2 to 4% at best when you measure electricity and real measures and stuff. So they overstate it, and then they revise those numbers on employment or GDP a year from now when nobody, when the markets don't care. That's what they do.
That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty right there.
Yeah.
It's, there's two tactics. One is delay, right? You know, delay the vote, delay the answer, delay Syria, delay, and hopefully everything is gone. You forget about it. Just think about all the different things that have been delayed for years. For example, they delayed the remember, do you remember when Bernanke wouldn't give up the names and the amounts of the money that the Fed gave the banks through the financial crisis? Remember that whole thing?
Because, of course not, because they gave it all to the banks.
Right. But the numbers, the big banks didn't want the numbers to be released. Goldman didn't want whatever.
Of course not. Yeah.
But they were okay to release it 2 years later because you look 2 years later or at a time where people... And this is the kind of environment that we live in. I'm not saying it's conspiratorial. I'm not saying that really. I'm just saying that it's really not as transparent as they would like to tell us it is. And when we see that there are... questionable numbers, like the 7.3% unemployment rate, we all know at this point is bogus.
Yeah, it's when you adjust for the people that have voluntarily dropped out of the workforce because they can't get good jobs, or they're second moms saying, I've got my kids out of college and I don't work. It's 11.4%,
right.
And if you adjust for the underemployment of people who have to take part-time jobs, which is the only sector really growing because they can't get full-time jobs, it's like 14%. This is like, you know, worse than 1982. And of course, the government statistics don't reflect this because they want you to feel good about the economy, and I don't blame them. They're in the, hey, as long as we keep people's confidence up, they'll still spend. But I'm telling you, this is not going to last because here's the thing, Andrew. The middle class, the average person in America, peaked in their spending, the baby boom, in 2007. As we forecast 20 years ago what happened on a 46-year lag on the immigration-adjusted birth index. But the upper class, the top 10 to 20%, who have 3.5% unemployment with college degrees, and who go to school later and start their families later and put their kids through school later, they're not going to peak until 2013-14, and then they're going to fall off the cliff. And you know what? They're just 10% or 20% of the economy, but they're 50 to 60% of spending. The wealthy dominate our economy, and in China, the top 10% control 60% of spending and 90% of assets and real estate and everything. So I see this second demographic cliff coming in the next year or two, where finally the affluent stop spending. And guess who owns all these overinflated real estate, stock, commodity assets? It's the top 0.1%, 1%, 10%, 20%. When the economy finally falls again as it did in 2008, it's not going to be the middle class that gets hit. They already got hit. They've already been hit since 2000 when real wages have been going down with the Asian deflation and wages and the all these gains going to the top 1 to 10%. When this economy goes down, the top percent are going to get hit unbelievably in their wealth impact, and the Fed is solely relying on goosing this top 1 to 10 to 20% of households with rising asset and stock prices to keep them spending, and this is going to fail in next year.
The simple reason is they don't have anything else they can do. And,
they don't have anything. Exactly.
You know, there's nothing else they can. It's not their fault. They just don't have any tools beyond, you know. I think that one of the greatest things that they ever did was come out with a new tool called communication. I said, how does that work? Well, basically, what it is just them mouthing off stuff to make everybody feel good. It's cheerleading, is what it is. You know, it's not open to transparency. I have a question for you. I think it was in your book, The Great Boom Ahead. What year did you write that?
1992. I wrote that in early 1992. It came out in November 1992. And
was that the one?
The whole boom in the United States and Europe, and the whole collapse in Japan, and nobody saw it coming.
But you had the chart that you were talking about, where you have the age, I think, was it up to 54, right? 30, 20?
Well, actually, 46 is the peak in spending of the average family.
Right.
So we move forward the birth index in the United States, and we adjust for inflation. I mean, I'm sorry, for immigrants, legal and illegal, which I only started doing in 1996, when my forecast of a Dow 10,000 by the early 2000s was obviously lower than I expected. I adjusted for immigrants, and then it hit the curve. But, I mean, people spend money, earn money, raise their kids, buy houses predictably as they age. And when a new generation does this, and people don't understand, Andrew, the size of the baby boom generation. We have not seen a generation this large in the United States, especially with all the immigrants that we attracted, since the American Revolution in the late 1700s.
Hmm.
New generations cause massive innovation when they're young, massive booms when they age, and then massive political change when they're older and in power. And for the baby booms, the biggest thing around the world that's ever happened, and I hate to say it, Andrew, I was lucky when I was consulting to big businesses at Bain & Company and then small businesses in the early to late 1980s to trip on demographics and see how big this baby boom was in innovations and technologies and in spending and adoption of technologies. But they're done. They're over. They're never going to buy bigger houses again. And the next generation is smaller, and more baby boomers are going to die in the next decade or two than the next generation buy new houses. So real estate will never be the same. Our stock markets will go up again after this downturn, but they'll never boom like they did from 1983 to 2007, which actually was a actual 46-year lag.
Yeah, I have that chart. I got a few of your charts. It's ingrained in my head. And I have to go find that and pull it out and maybe post it on this episode's show notes, because it was the reason why I asked you when you published that was, you know, I think it's important to put in perspective the length of time that we're talking about, and the general accuracy of how these economics, demographic patterns and trends, and then eventual cycles work into the situations. But we're gonna have to end it here. Listen, everybody, check out Harry's newsletter. It's at harrydent.com. It's called Survive and Prosper. He talks about the various triggers. We talked about the European crisis, Greece, and of course commodity prices falling, China's exports falling, the company's earnings growth slowing down, and the rise that's happening with interest rates and the Fed. I mean, these are all on here and in more detail, and he puts out a lot of things in his newsletter. One of the things he puts out just recently was all about how we're going to be having to work much longer in our lives as we, in developed countries. And that's a great article I think you need to take a look at. HarryDent.com. And, of course, you find all that information not only on his site, but we'll put all of it on where you can get to it on the show notes for this particular episode. Harry, thanks so much. You're great.
Great. Thank you, Andrew.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. What do you think of that? Harry Dent. Those numbers that he's saying about gold and markets are kind of spooky. I would have to, if we had a debate and we're going through it, and I wasn't just trying to really extract a lot of information of what his opinions were, I would have to really question how we get to all those numbers. But, his cycles are pretty solid, and we'll just have to play it by how it goes right now, watch the tape, as they say, and see what happens. I did want to mention to you a couple of things. First of all, this week coming up, we do have two major companies. A few things happening, but it's the end of the cycle of earnings season. As a matter of fact, Alcoa is going to be on, I believe, October 8th, which is, 2.5-3 weeks away, till the next earnings season starts, because Alcoa is the company that kicks off earnings season. It's just how it is. So what's really interesting is that we have two companies. We have Oracle and we have Adobe. Now, Adobe did a lot of changes recently that they have a new subscription model for their software, and there's a lot of reasons why they did that. You have piracy issues. You have regular income that you can project a lot better. Update cycles are a little bit different. And Now, also, you have Oracle coming out, which is has had two very poor quarters back-to-back, and the stock is very reflective of that in terms of the price and action. We'll see what happens with that. Oracle has been seeing a lot of competition that has been taking their business, and also it's really not in great shape. So the very different characteristics of each company in terms of how the stock has performed and how the company itself has actually performed. We'll see how that plays out. Keep your eye on that, because I think, you know, especially with Oracle, it's going to be a big item to look at when you look at many of the other companies that are in a similar business. But, you know, we'll see. It oftentimes when a company does have serial quarters of very poor earnings, especially a company as great as Oracle, they make a lot of changes to make sure that they're not going to continue down that road if, in fact, you know, the economy's okay and there's nothing major, you know, that's happening with the company other than the fact that, you know, business is soft and maybe they have some competition. But, you know, we'll see what happens there. And Adobe has really exceeded expectations when it comes to what analysts were looking for, because they thought there would be a pretty good drop in terms of their overall earnings for some time due to the change over to the new model of subscriptions for a lot of their products. But they have done a great job of keeping things really tight. So we'll see how those both play out. And we'll end on this. I want to mention we did this last September. We gave away a coupon for a pretty significant discount on TriggerPoint Research Alerts, where you get the email messages or the emails or texts or whatever you want it when a stock is either breaking up, breaking down, bouncing, et cetera. The three different packages, whether it's a pro package where you get all the above, or the breaking up or the breaking down. And all you have to do is go over to TriggerPointResearch.com and sign up, and you get a 35% discount off your first month. It's only good for new subscribers, because the old subscribers give all sorts of things too. And we have lots of new goodies since last year that we've added to the offering, actually, where you get the setups and the on a regular basis, and also you get more than just the alerts. So you just simply use the coupon code 8A2E. As in Edward, 43, F as in Frank, 9. We'll put that on the show notes as well. We'll tuck it in there. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.